The Guardian.
I'm Ben Green, and this is Science Extra from The Guardian. In 1996, Alan Sokal, a professor of physics at New York University, wrote a paper for a cultural studies journal entitled Transgressing the Boundaries Towards the Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. It was published, reviewed, and lauded, but Sokal soon confessed that the article was actually a hoax. The incident became front-page news around the world and triggered fierce and wide-ranging controversy, known by many as the Science Wars. Sokal's just written about the hoax in a new book, and when he came into the Guardian offices recently, he spoke to science correspondent Alok Jha.
Alan, can you tell us where the idea for the hoax came from?
Yeah, well, it all started in the summer of 1994. I saw a reference to a book by a biologist, Paul Gross, and a mathematician, Norman Levitt, entitled Higher Superstition, The Academic Left and Its Quarrels with Science. And my first thought was, oh, it's another one of these right-wing treatises about how the left-wing university professors are taking over our universities and brainwashing our children and so on. But then I thought, academic left and its quarrels with science? This is strange. I'm a member of the academic left. I don't have a quarrel with science. I didn't know that the academic left did have a quarrel with science. So I got the book and read it and learned about a certain subset of people in the humanities and social sciences, certainly not everyone in that area by any means, postmodernist-oriented intellectuals who were writing about science and its philosophy and making a complete bungle of both and arguing that science was a mere social construction with no claim to objective knowledge of the external world. And so the first thing I did was I ran to the library to read the works that these people were criticizing to see whether they were being fair. And I found that in about 80% of the cases, they were being fair. And then with a little more library research, I found even worse examples from even more prominent authors, mostly French and American. And then I thought, hey, you know, what should I do with what I've discovered in the library? I could write yet another article criticizing them and it would fall into a black hole like all the others and be ignored. But then I thought maybe it would be more fun and maybe more useful to write an article praising them. So I wrote a parody of a postmodernist science criticism article.
Can I just give the title here? It's the Transgressing the Boundaries Towards the Transformative Hermeneutics of Quantum Gravity. I don't know what most of those words mean, but so why don't you tell us what you're trying to do there?
Right. So it was an experiment, admittedly an uncontrolled experiment. I wrote a parody of this postmodern science criticism filled with scientific blunders, filled with non sequiturs from beginning to end, to see whether it could be accepted as a serious scholarly article in a trendy academic journal. And to my surprise, it was.
The journal in question was Social Text, and this was at the time a non-peer-reviewed journal looking at what? Postmodernism?
Well, it's more general. It's a fairly well-known journal in the field of cultural studies, which basically means people with a literary background trying to, if you want, practice sociology without a license, study culture in general. And some of them wanted to go so far as to comment on science, which is perfectly legitimate if they comment from a basis of some knowledge. But unfortunately, they weren't doing that. And to my surprise, this article was accepted for publication.
And so it was a special edition of Social Text, which focused on something called the Science Wars. This was the battle you sort of alluded to earlier between the postmodernists and scientists, I guess. Can you give us a brief rundown, if it's possible, of what that was?
Right. Well, first I should say I very much dislike the term science wars, which was invented by one of the editors of Social Text. I mean, this is not a war. This is an intellectual debate. I'm not trying to kill anyone. Simply, we're trying to discuss ideas. Basically, the issue is to what extent is science actually discovering something objective, albeit incomplete and fallible about the world, or to what extent is science a mere social construction on a par, for example, with myths and religions? Now, most scientists, and I think most citizens, think that science is a fallible but nevertheless powerful method for uncovering real knowledge about the world, from quarks to quasars and everything else in between. And so it came to me as some surprise to find that there were significant currents within the humanities and the social sciences that were denying that.
Now, the reaction of the editors of the social text was quite interesting. They claimed that you had recanted on your argument or something. So instead of blaming themselves for publishing something that was incorrect, they blamed you for having a bad argument. I mean, can you...
Well, they made a bunch of different reactions, which were a little bit embarrassing on their part. But I don't really want to harp on the reaction of the editors of social text, because they're not my enemies in any sense. They're not even my main intellectual targets. And I think now the important thing is not what mistakes the social text editors made or why they accepted a manifestly bogus article that they admit themselves they couldn't understand. That's not the most serious problem. The most serious problem is, why was there such a strong current within some sectors, at least, of the humanities and social sciences, commenting on science and criticizing science based on an inadequate knowledge of it?
What was the response from scientists and other philosophers and sociologists to your work?
Right. Well, the response from scientists was obviously mostly favorable. The response from philosophers was also mostly favorable. I should say that philosophy, at least within the English-speaking world, has not gone, for the most part, for postmodernist ideas. Philosophers of science are mostly sober types who, in fact, in many cases, have undergraduate science degrees before they went into philosophy. From the social sciences and the humanities, the reaction was mixed. And in fact, there was a large amount of support for me from people within the humanities and social sciences who had been criticizing these ideas for a long time themselves, but weren't being listened to. And so they were very happy for an outsider to kind of break into this debate and drop a bomb and open up the debate. In particular, students in the field, many, many students wrote me emails saying, thank you for helping to open up a debate so that I can finally voice in class the doubts that I had about my professor's doctrine, but was afraid to express openly.
Was this a case of Emperor's New Clothes or something?
I think that's a little bit the case. That's certainly an analogy which was alluded to very often in that debate.
So now it's more than 10 years since the hoax, and you've written extensively about it, you've collected together some of your essays in a new book. Can you tell me generally what's been the impact of that, those science wars? I know you don't like the term, but those things, and also the hoax now in science. I mean, what's been the discussion and then the intervening 10 years?
Right. Well, I think there was a big debate in the first few years after 1996 when the hoax came out. And I think the result over the long term was that the postmodernists and extreme social constructivists backed off from some of their most extreme claims, which they realized they were unable to defend, and are now defending more modest claims with which one may still disagree, but at least are no longer so extreme. Now, I guess I and other like-minded critics of postmodernism can take some small credit for that. But I have to say, honestly, I think 90% of the credit has to be given to George Bush and his friends, who have shown where science bashing can lead in the real world. And one example is Bruno Latour, a prominent sociologist of science, who spent several decades stressing the so-called social construction of scientific facts, as he called it, and now laments the ammunition that he fears that he and his colleagues have given to the Republican right wing to allow them to obscure or deny the scientific consensus on issues like global warming, biological evolution, secondhand tobacco smoke, and so on.
That particular issue is something you raise in your new book as well, this idea that it's not science that you want to promote, it's the scientific worldview. Do you think that now, in the 21st century, the technological age, that we have enough of this? We have enough sort of respect for the scientific worldview?
Well, unfortunately not. That's I think, the main problem. Of course, we live in a world where the technological products of science are ubiquitous. But unfortunately, the scientific worldview, the scientific way of thinking, the evidence-based way of thinking, if you want to call it that, is very far from being even understood by the general public. And I think we scientists have to take a lot of the blame for that. We take for granted so much our way of thinking that we don't spend enough time explaining to the general public how we distinguish, for example, between real science and pseudoscience. We have some instinctive way of doing this, but of course it's not just an instinct. There's a pattern, there's a method, but we need to take more time to try to explain this method to the general public.
I mean, one of your arguments is that 10 years ago you had various literary critics, essentially, or cultural critics, talking about science, and so they should. But still, scientists don't want to talk about anything apart from their speciality. Yet you're a physicist talking essentially about culture. Why do you think that's important for scientists to be getting involved in things like this?
Well, of course, we scientists tend to be cautious when stepping out of our own field because we know how easy it is to make a fool of ourselves. Even in a closely related subject, for example, a physicist talking about chemistry, much less talking about culture in general. But I think at least some of us scientists should try to explain to the general public as best we can more general issues about what is science, how do we do science, what good reasons are there for believing at least some of the results of science, and with how much of a grain of salt should we also take the results of science. For example, one thing that I want to stress that scientists, again, take for granted, but sometimes the general public doesn't realize and journalists often don't stress enough to their readers, is the distinction between well-tested science on the one hand, which is 90% right, and cutting-edge science, which is actually 90% wrong. There's a filtering process that science goes through to go from cutting-edge to well-tested. And of course, it's understandable the journalists will want to present cutting-edge science to their readers, but it's important to make clear that this may not be right. This has to be tested by other scientists. Experiments have to be replicated. They have to be redone in different ways. It may end up being wrong.
And it's okay to be wrong.
And it's okay to be wrong precisely because when a scientist does cutting-edge science, they're not claiming to be certain to be right. They're putting out a plausible conjecture which needs to be tested by other scientists. And then gradually through this filtering process, some fraction of that cutting-edge science becomes well-established science.
Let's go back to the cultural aspects of this. You mentioned the Republican right in the United States at the moment and how they've bashed science. Can you give us some more examples and more specific examples of how this scientific worldview is being disrespected around the world?
Right. Well, let me give an example from here in Britain. The NHS actively promotes homeopathy on its website as one of many so-called complementary and alternative therapies, and spend an unknown amount of money on homeopathy. The NHS doesn't bother to keep track. Nevertheless, homeopathy is a completely implausible system of medicine, and it's not so difficult to explain to the general public why. So let me take 1 minute to try to explain why. Now, the first reason is simply that if you look at the clinical trials, there is no good statistical evidence that homeopathy is effective beyond the placebo effect. But that's not the strongest argument against homeopathy. Most people don't realize what homeopathy is. They probably think of it as a species of herbal medicine. And of course, plants contain many substances which can be biologically active with either positive or harmful consequences, as Socrates found out. But homeopathy is very different. Homeopathic remedies are so highly diluted that in most cases they do not contain a single molecule of the alleged active ingredient. And so what that means is there is no plausible mechanism by which homeopathy could possibly have a therapeutic effect beyond the placebo effect, unless one rejects everything that we've learned in 200 years of study of physics and chemistry, namely that matter is made of atoms and that the properties of matter, in particular its chemical and biological effects, depend on its atomic structure. There is no way that a vanished so-called active ingredient could possibly have a therapeutic effect. So the problem is not just that the statistical studies are negative or inconclusive. It's that there's no plausible mechanism. Now, the advocates of homeopathy sometimes respond to this argument by saying, yes, but the water in which the active ingredient is dissolved retains some kind of memory of the active ingredient even after the active ingredient has disappeared. Now, once again, the problem is not merely that there's no reliable experimental evidence for any kind of memory of water like that. The problem is that, again, this, if such a phenomenon were to exist, it would contradict well-tested science, namely the statistical mechanics of liquids, which teaches us that in a liquid, the molecules are constantly bumping against other molecules, and any memory of their past configuration is very quickly lost. And when I say quickly, I'm not talking about months or years. I'm talking nanoseconds. So the bottom line is that homeopathy has no good evidence in its favor and is incompatible with everything we've learned about physics and chemistry in the last 200 years. In other words, all the millions of experiments in favor of modern physics and chemistry are so many experiments also against homeopathy. Now, that's the main reason why scientists like myself are skeptical, to put it mildly, about homeopathy, not merely the lack of decent placebo-controlled statistical studies at the 95% confidence level.
And yet, this is something that pervades all around the world. I mean, in your essays, you also talk about sort of spiritualist healing and medicine in India.
Right. I mean, homeopathy, of course, is popular in Europe and in many places. In India, there's another interesting phenomenon which was brought to light in a very interesting book by the sociologist of science, Meera Nanda, where she shows that in India there was a confluence, an intellectual confluence, not a conspiracy, but an intellectual confluence between two apparently opposite trends. On the one hand, the postmodernist, postcolonialist left-wing critics of science who claimed that science was merely a Western import or Western imposition, which is contrary to India's cultural mores and which in any case has no claim to objective validity. And on the other side, the right-wing Hindu nationalists who were saying, yes, absolutely right, absolutely right. We in India need our own science based on our own culture, in particular Ayurvedic medicine, Vedic astrology, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, this was a serious issue because the BJP, the Hindu Nationalist Party, was actually in power in India and the government for 6 or 7 years, and they implemented some of these things. They started faculties of Vedic astrology in the universities. They started promoting various brands of pseudoscience in the schools.
One might argue, actually, that things like Ayurvedic medicine and homeopathy, they're kind of harmless in a sense because they might be based on incorrect sort of viewings of the world. But they don't do any harm. But actually,
well, homeopathic remedies are definitely harmless because, as I said, they're so highly diluted, they are placebos. They contain nothing but water and starch. So you can't get an overdose of a homeopathic remedy. The only way they're dangerous for two reasons. First of all, they waste money. Every time the NHS pays a homeopathic provider, that's wasting money that could be used on provably effective treatments, for example, for cancer patients who aren't getting them for lack of money. Secondly, of course, if homeopathic remedies divert patients from alternate conventional remedies, which are effective, that again is dangerous.
But this idea of not respecting evidence is quite interesting to me. It doesn't just apply to things like medicine or things that have evidence bases like the tradition that we think of traditionally. And what about political decisions?
That, I think, is the main point. The habit of disrespecting evidence is the serious problem, more serious than any particular harm that's done by, let's say, homeopathy or any other pseudo-medicine. And I think the extreme example of disregard for evidence was the selling of the war in Iraq by Bush and Blair. They were clearly not trying to dispassionately use intelligence information to evaluate the pros and cons of different policies. They had clearly determined a policy in advance, namely to go to war to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and then pressured their intelligence agencies to find, quote, evidence, be it exaggerated, tendentiously interpreted, even in some cases just utterly fraudulent, so-called evidence, in order to mislead the public and Congress and Parliament into supporting their war. That, I think, is far more dangerous than anything that all the homeopaths in Britain could concoct.
Are you optimistic that people are recognizing this, though? You mentioned the sociologists themselves are kind of ruining their own sort of ideas in the light of George Bush's faith-based presidency, as you call it. Are people getting more aware of this, and are you optimistic that this is going to be a problem that will be solved?
Well, I don't know, to tell you the truth. Perhaps, I mean, people are certainly having their eyes opened about the war in Iraq 5 years too late. The evidence was there at the time of the war in Iraq, and there was a huge failure of journalism, especially in the United States and to some extent here in Britain as well, to expose what were already evident then, even on the basis of the publicly available evidence then, as lies or misrepresentations. There was too much support the government if we're going to war anyway, rally round king and country, you might call it here. Whether journalists have learned from that and will be more critical next time, I don't know. I hope so, but of course I'm worried because the misrepresentations will be different next time around. There's no point in fighting the last war, if I could put it that way. The important thing is to develop a critical frame of mind where we rationally evaluate all the assertions that are made to us, and we neither reject them out of hand nor accept them uncritically, but ask, what's the evidence for this?
This focus on evidence actually is the same as the kind of message that Richard Dawkins and the sort of neo-atheists are sort of have been arguing for a while now. You know, we should be focusing on evidence, not faith. Faith shouldn't have any special place in government anywhere. Do you agree with all of those? And what are your opinions on the way that the neo-atheism has sort of risen in the last few years?
Well, the word faith is being used by its advocates, for example, Tony Blair, who was pushing for faith-based schools, as a kind of ecumenical-sounding euphemism for religion. But it's actually not such a bad term, because what is faith except what the kind of pseudo-justification that some people trot out when they lack adequate evidence? So the fundamental thing is that, yes, faith is a violation of the evidence-based worldview. The evidence-based worldview says public policy should be based on evidence. Everyone in a free society has the perfect right to believe any nonsense they choose, but the rest of us are not obliged to take those opinions seriously. We should only take seriously those arguments that are based on evidence. So our culture's deference to faith is I think, extremely counterproductive.
And what about the arguments of Richard Dawkins, Dan Dennett, Sam Harris, though? I mean, are you yourself an atheist, and do you agree with the way they've done things?
Right. Well, I myself am an atheist simply because, in my best rational judgment based on the evidence, there's no compelling evidence that an entity corresponding to what most believers call God, you know, a supernatural being that would listen to our prayers and so on, actually exists. So I'm an atheist towards the Jewish, Christian, Muslim, and Hindu gods in exactly the same way that I think most of the listeners here are atheists towards Zeus and Thor, nothing more than that. Now, as far as these different books, of course, it's a lot to comment on. In my own book, I discuss in detail Sam Harris's book and explain the things that I like about it and the things that I think leave something to be desired. Richard Dawkins' book, I guess my main criticism of it is, I mean, I think it's a great book, but I think he bit off too much, or at least bit off more than I would bite off. He tried to address various different criticisms of religion, and in particular, he tried to argue that religion has a negative net effect in the world. Now, I'd tend to agree, but it's a very complicated debate. Does a particular idea do good or bad in the world? And it's a diversion from the more fundamental question is, are these doctrines true or false? Is there any evidence for them or not? It's very strange that nowadays defenders of religion, like, for example, Alistair McGrath, a professor of theology at Oxford and author of the book The Dawkins Delusion, which I admit is a clever title, he spends most of his time trying to argue about the good things that religion does in the world. Well, great, but what about the truth or falsity of Christian doctrines? I mean, in the old days, 100 years ago or 200 years ago, defenders of Christianity didn't merely argue that Christian people do good things in the world. They argued that their doctrines are true. This is a very funny retreat.
Can I wind up by asking you about some physics?
Sure.
We've kind of gone through this discussion talking about how taking ideas seriously only if there's evidence for them. One of the things that we've discussed on our podcast regularly is string theory. This is the cutting edge of physics, so bear in mind that this could be wrong, of course. Lee Smolin, your colleague and also a friend of the pod, has come in to talk about what he thinks is the trouble with things like string theory. String theory has no evidence behind it, yet it is the major occupation of most physicists.
Well, most physicists is too far. There's a subset.
Working on quantum gravity.
Working on quantum gravity,
So what do you have to say about that?
Well, Lee is an old friend of mine, and I think his book, The Trouble with Physics, gives a very balanced assessment of string theory. Now, you have to realize string theory is cutting-edge science. It's speculative. It's not purporting to be the truth about the world yet. It's a research area. It's a research program, which might turn out to be nothing and might turn out to be the right future theory of quantum gravity. And so it has to be evaluated as a research program. We don't evaluate cutting-edge science the same way that we evaluate something purporting to be well-tested science, purporting to be the truth about the world. So that's the first thing. So Lee's book, I think, gives a very balanced, to my mind, assessment of string theory as a research program. In what ways has it succeeded? And it has succeeded in some ways. It gives explanations of some things that in previous physics were unexplained. On the other hand, it fails to give some other explanations that people at first were hopeful that it would give. And so the question is, after 20 years, is string theory still a viable research program? And my attitude, which I think is also the same as Lee's, is yes, people should continue to do research in string theory because it is a promising area for a possible solution to the problem of quantum gravity. But it shouldn't be taking 90% of the resources in that area. That's the problem, that we need more variety of ideas in this area, simply because the problem of putting together quantum mechanics and general relativity to get a theory of quantum gravity is incredibly difficult. And the most likely thing is that all of the existing ideas are wrong, and that we need new ideas. Maybe all of the existing ideas are wrong, but they also contain some ingredients which will eventually be part of the right theory. We don't know, because we're still in a revolutionary period in science, the same way that physics was in this revolutionary period between 1900 and 1925, before modern quantum mechanics finally emerged. And so string theory should not be rejected as a research program, but we need to encourage alternatives to string theory also.
I know that you're quite worried that your tombstone will have the SoCal affair hoax on it. You're worried that that's the only thing that people will remember about you. But what do you hope is the message that scientists and members of the public will take away from the last 10 years of discussion around the hoax?
And other
work you've done, of course.
Right. In my mind, the hoax is not the most important thing. I mean, academic postmodernists are a completely lightweight target, both intellectually and politically, compared to pseudoscience, religion, and dishonest politicians. But I think the theme that unites all of these is that all of us, whether we're liberal or conservative, atheist or believer, we live in the same real world, whether we like it or not, and public policy needs to be based on the best available evidence about that world.
Alan, can I finish with a quote from the end of your preface to your new book, which I think sort of sums up this last half hour quite succinctly. You say, "My motivations in writing this book are thus both intellectual and political, but I have tried hard to keep the two questions separate. Sympathy with an author's motivations, political or otherwise, can never constitute a valid reason for accepting his or her arguments, and opposition to those motivations can never constitute a valid reason for rejecting them. The arguments must be analysed in their own right. The reader will judge how well I've done this." Alan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Alan Sokal speaking to The Guardian science correspondent Alok Jha. For more interviews like this, listen to the Science Weekly podcast at guardian.co.uk/audio.
The Guardian.